Good evening. One of the topics that is relevant to things on our mind is the proper consequences and treatment of murderers. And it's a theme that is addressed in this week's Parsha. The Parsha, addressing all of humanity, tells us that the price to be paid for Shvichas Damim is, at least theoretically, that the murderer should be executed. Shofech Dam Ha'adam, Ba'adam Dama Yishafech. That one who spills the blood of another, so his blood should be spilled. So what exactly that implies for criminal policy and in the context of the justice system of a secular government is an interesting question and an important question. So if one were to ask, what should United States policy be, for example, as far as Jewish wisdom is concerned, so that's not such an easy question to answer, because on the one hand, we have a pasuk such as this, and we know also that we have many other chiyuvei misa throughout the Torah. So the concept of the death penalty certainly seems to be a very real idea and a very real presence. And yet, at the same time, so many are familiar with another statement in Chazal, Gemara Maseches Makos, that a Beis Din that executed once every 7 years, and then the other opinion is once every 70 years, is considered to be a bloody Beis Din. And the implication being that this is not something that's really meant to be utilized too often at all, if at all. So what exactly is the actual path here? So many assume that the reconciliation is that the death penalty is something that's meant to exist on the books, is meant to show the chumras ha'isser, perhaps, and meant to be a deterrent, maybe. But in practice, it was not really meant to be utilized, or maybe utilized very rarely. So that might be true. It's a possibility. But in order to come to that conclusion, we have to consider it in a little bit more detail, because the truth is there are at least three different contexts in which any source that talks about the capital punishment might be located. We have, on the one hand, the Sanhedrin, which is mandated to carry out the Chiyuv Misa in the context of many Averos. We have also the notion of the Sanhedrin executing somebody in an extra-legal fashion in order to protect society, which we'll explain in a little more detail. And we also have what's really relevant to this week's Parsha, and is also really sourced in last week's Parsha, even though it sounds like it's more connected to this week's Parsha, but the concept of Din B'nai Noach, and the notion of the mitzvah of Din, specifically, among the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach. And that also includes its own rules, including the death penalty. So when you have any reference, any halachic source that talks about capital punishment, it would seem to be important to first try to ascertain what exactly is the context. So to take it one at a time, if we look at the Sanhedrin dealing with the standard Chiyuvei Misa, so it certainly does seem to be the case that you would have to really hire a fancy lawyer to get executed. It's very hard to get executed in the Sanhedrin, and the idea that it would only happen maybe once every 7 or 70 years is easily understood, because it's quite a challenge. In order to have a actual Chiyuv Misa carried out, so there are many obstacles. many hurdles. So first of all, you have to have the crime witnessed by two Edim, meaning two Edim Ksherim, so adult Jewish males who are not invalidated for any other reason of personal behavior or status, and who are not related to each other or to the defendant in any way. And that's just to begin with. Then these Edim have to give Hasra to the person in question. And that's also quite a challenge, the idea that they're able to see what's going to happen and anticipate the crime and actually tell the individual beforehand not to do it and explain to him what the consequences would be. It's a machlokas rishonim, just how specific they have to be, but they have to at least convey to him that he's about to commit an avera that has the consequence of misa. And not only that, but it gets even harder. He has to be matir asmo lemitza. He has to actually accept the hasra. So that's really quite unlikely, that the idea the individual is going to actually not only commit his avera in front of witnesses who are going to have an opportunity to warn him in advance, but he's also going to accept the hasra willingly. And that standard is a little bit of a insight into what's going on. There are a couple of theories to explain what the idea of Kabbalah's Hasra is. It overlaps with some philosophical questions. The whole issue of the morality of the death penalty is, of course, a topic of great debate in general society. And in the early days of America, before the nation was officially founded, so in the colonial era, it was a hot debate, and many of the founding fathers were death penalty abolitionists. They weren't necessarily such fans of the death penalty. And many of them were influenced by an Italian philosopher whose name was Cesare Beccaria. And he argued against the death penalty. And one of his arguments was that it's inherently immoral because the whole power of the state, of the government, to do anything comes from the consent of the governed, in his understanding, that the people agree to let the government rule over them, and nobody would ever give the government the right to kill them. So therefore, that right doesn't exist, and it's immoral to utilize it. And other philosophers disagreed with that, and they understood that the notion of consent to the government, it doesn't mean that you fill out a form and you check off all the specific rights that you're giving over to the government. It means that in total, you accept the authority of the government, and then the details of what they do is up to them. So the notion of being mekabel, the authority, there were some who want to suggest that that's what's going on here also, that the idea of being matir asmo lemitza, that you accept the hasra, is reflected in this concept, that you are accepting upon yourself the authority of Beis Din with this Kabbalah hasra. But there's an even more striking detail, which adds another level of difficulty, and that is that the hasra has to be given within toch kedei dibur of the avera. And if it's more than toch kedei dibur, so then you have to worry that maybe, as Rashi and Ksuvos explains, that maybe the individual forgot the hasra. So that seems very implausible. Toch kedei dibur is a maximum of about 9 seconds. So to say that he actually forgot, you can imagine somebody is warned that the avera he's about to do is going to get him executed, and then he goes ahead and does it, and then you say to him, but you know, didn't you get the hasra? And he's, well, yeah, you know, that was like 30 seconds ago. You can't expect me to remember. So what exactly do we mean? This is something that Ktzos HaChoshen, for example, was very troubled with. How could it be that we really think you forget after Toch kedei dibur? And Rav Soloveitchik explained that the idea of hasra, what the purpose it's meant to accomplish. The Gemara has a view, it's a machlokes, the Gemara, they have a view that the purpose of Hasra is lahavchin ben shogeg lemezid, that we're there to establish that the individual is amazed. So normally we translate that as somebody who's aware that what he's doing is prohibited. But it could be that it means more than just awareness of the Avera, that perhaps we're trying to assess here a higher level of mezid. I believe the Rabbi used the language, ad heichan hu parekol, to what level is this individual so rebellious against society that he's not only willing to commit this Avera because he wants to, but he's doing it in such a super rebellious way that he's going to commit the Avera specifically now when he has received this Hasra and it is fresh in his mind. It's in his active consciousness. It's not just that he's aware that he could retrieve the information if you'd ask him. So yes, of course, he hasn't forgotten in that sense that if you'd ask him, he would be aware of it. It means that we have to have it on his active consciousness, that he's actively thinking about it right now, and he's committing the Avera with the focus on all of this knowledge. So such a level of mezid is the standard that we're talking about. And as others explain, that somebody who could do it under those circumstances, that's the kind of incorrigibility that we're looking for in terms of a standard for execution. So if you have all those things in place, you have the two Eidim giving the Hasra, and he's makabel the Hasra, tochnei dibur, then you bring him to trial. So that's not enough yet to execute him. But then he can be brought to trial. And then there is a bias to exonerate. There's a mitzvah of Itzilu Eda that the Sanhedrin has to try to do everything they can to find schus for him. It's a different structure than the American court system, for example, where you have a prosecutor and a defense attorney, and the jury is there to decide whether he's guilty or innocent, and the judge is there to preside, and the witnesses are there to give evidence. So here in this system, so you have the Eidim are essentially the prosecutors and the executioners. They're there to bring the case against the person, and they would also carry it out if he's found guilty. And the Dayanim are playing three roles, that they're there to be the judges, and they're also there to be the jury, because they're going to vote on guilt or innocence, and they're also the defense attorneys, because they're also obligated to try to find schus, and that's what ultimately contributes to the idea of having 23 Dayanim, because you need to have an Eda that's going to theoretically be arguing for his schus, and you have to be able to win by more than one, and you have to also have an odd number, so you end up having 23. And the Gemara says also that if one of the Dayanim should happen to have seen the crime, so then he's puzzled to be a Dayan here, an Eid Nice Dayan. And the reason is because he's not going to be able to argue in his defense. Because since he knows too much, since he saw it happen, he's going to be biased against the defendant, and that's going to impact on his ability to be the defense attorney, which is a fundamental part of his job. And then, together with that, there is what might even be the most striking halacha in this. And this is a halacha that Judge Antonin Scalia was fond of referencing, and he called this a very Jewish concept. The idea that the Gemara in Sanhedrin says that Bezdin Sharo Kulu Lechova, so that if there is a unanimous verdict, so here's another very big difference from what you find in the secular civil American court system. In the American court system, so you need to have a unanimous jury in order to convict it. If there's anything less than a unanimous jury, so then you're stuck. But in the case of the Sanhedrin, so if you have a unanimous verdict, so then that's bad. Then you let him go. And Scalia was fascinated by this concept, which he said was a very Jewish concept. There is a minority view, the view of the Meiri, that read this Gemara differently, and he understood it to mean Pochonos on Miad, that the way maybe it's a little more intuitive, but still the minority understanding, that normally you're trying to keep things going longer and stalling to try to see if there'll be any zchus for this guy. But if it's unanimous, so then we know he's definitely guilty, so then you take him right away to be executed, you don't stall at all. But everyone else understands the opposite way, that if there's a unanimous vote, so then you let him go right away. So why that is an interesting question. There are those who say that nothing can be so clear-cut. It can't be that there's no other possibility. So if it's 100%, so then it's got to be wrong. I think that's part of what Scalia found so fascinating. My grandfather, in a sefer from the Torah Tumim, Meshuvas Nefesh, has a whole essay about this, which is not printed in the newer versions. They printed the Choriv edition of Torah Tumima, so they have Meshivas Nefesh on the bottom. It's selections from the same, from the one volume, Meshivas Nefesh. He has a long essay about this topic where he writes he doesn't think that that could be the pshat, that the idea that, oh, nothing could be so simple that everyone agrees. And there are clearly some things that are both unanimous and true. So it can't be that that's really the pshat. It sounds like a sharp thing to say, but it's probably not really accurate. So you have to figure out exactly what the pshat is. But it could be that because there is a chiyuv for at least some of the dayanim to be working in defense of this guy, so if there aren't any votes on his behalf, so then there's something lacking in that process, and therefore he gets off on an inadequate defense claim, and that there's something that is missing as far as that's concerned, and that's the problem. So essentially, the idea that it's very hard to be executed in Beis Din, there is a lot to back that up, and that's not even the whole story, because even with all that, so should the Dayanim feel that everything is in place, and they still don't, for whatever reason, want to carry out the Onesh, so then apparently they have the ability and sometimes the responsibility to drive the Edim so crazy with questions and with the Rishon Hakira that they're simply not going to be able to answer. And that's going to essentially allow them to direct the path of what's going on, which is itself interesting because, you know, the whole idea that the Torah relies here heavily on eyewitness testimony is a little bit of a challenge, because if you read any of the literature about eyewitness testimony, so it's a little scary. It's very scary because there's a notoriously high error rate. So it's amazing that anyone relies on an eyewitness testimony, because it's very, very common that there are mistakes. So the fact that the perfect Torah tells us to rely on eyewitness testimony is somewhat of a challenge, unless you look at the Rambam. So the Rambam says that it's the Gzeres HaKosev, and the Rambam says explicitly that we're well aware that it's possible for Edim to be lying, and more to the point, it's also possible for Edim simply to be wrong. That's what a lot of the recent literature has established, that it's much more possible than we may imagine that Edim could be wrong, but it's certainly also possible they could be lying, as the Rambam explicitly notes. And so the Torah is not claiming at all that the fact that we rely on two Edim means that they're objectively right. It doesn't mean that's necessarily the fact. It means that this is the system, it's Gzeres HaKosev. But also what it implies in both directions is that the Dayanim have some latitude in order to assess as they see what is actually accurate here, and so they can use the Edim when they believe that this is towards the path of justice, and when they think it isn't, then they can drive them so crazy with questions that it'll be impossible for them to answer, and then they have the ability essentially to disqualify any Edim, and that's how Rashi says in Makos also, where that whole discussion is expressed there about how one could essentially decide never to execute anyone, despite the fact that it would seem like the elements are there, and it's not necessarily in the control of the Dayanim. So apparently that's not true. The Dayanim do have the ability to control the process through that, and the Edim are essentially a tool rather than something that forces the hands of the Dayanim one way or another. So all of that does, again, make it pretty unlikely that there will be an execution. There are some interesting discussions in either direction. So the Or HaChaim and Chumash is a discussion, the Rav Yonasan Eibschitz and the Tumim is a different opinion. So there's a question, was once on a panel where it was asked about whether there is a discussion about jury nullification in halacha. So jury nullification is when, say, the jury has enough to convict somebody, but they don't think it's in the interests of justice, so the defense attorney convinces them to vote that he's not guilty, even though they know that he is guilty, because they believe that it's more in the interests of the law that he should be let off. So that's basically they're voting based not on what they think the truth is, but based on what they think justice actually requires. So you have some of that discussion here as well. So, for example, to go back to that din of Beis Din Shero Kul L'Chova. So let's say, for example, you have a dayan on a Sanhedrin who is convinced that this person is guilty and should be executed. But he realizes that all of his colleagues also feel that way. So he knows they're all going to vote guilty. So he realizes that if he votes guilty also, so it's going to be unanimous and he's going to get off. So should he essentially vote against what he believes? Is he allowed to do that? Is he allowed to vote not guilty so that the maskana will be that he is chayiv misa? Because we need a non-unanimous vote. So essentially it's the same question of the jury nullification, is that, and that was a machlokas, does a dayan have the right to vote based on what he thinks the maskana should be, or is he only allowed to vote what he thinks is the truth in front of him, and then that gets entered into the equation, and whatever the conclusion is going to be based on those parts put together. There's a similar question, for example, in Dinei Mamonos, because there, let's say, you have a Beis Din of three. So two vote for Reuven and one votes for Shimon, so Reuven wins. So let's say the one dayan who wants to vote for Shimon, so he knows he's going to lose to the other two, but he wants to try to give another chance for Shimon to win. So if he says, I don't know, instead of voting for Shimon, so then they'll have to add more dayanim. So then he'll have another chance. They'll bring on two more dayanim, and then he could try to convince the other two to vote for Shimon, and then they'll vote again, and it'll be 3-2. So does he have the right to vote, I don't know, when he really does know, and he's really convinced Shimon is right? But if he says, I don't know, so then Shimon won't lose so quickly, and then maybe he can allow Shimon another chance. So that's the same kind of question. Is he mechuyev to just vote what he thinks about the case? Or is he allowed to look to the broader justice and say that he may vote, so to speak, dishonestly within the facts in front of him in order to get what he might consider to be a more just conclusion? So all of that is relevant to this whole process of the Sanhedrin. And yes, it would seem pretty unlikely that there would actually be a conviction. Now, that would all be true as far as the Sanhedrin, but as we noted before, there are different systems also. And it's also worth noting there are different theories about what the purpose of punishment is. And it could be that those theories might be reflected in a machlokas rishonim, that the notion of the chi of misa is a mitzvah. It's actually a question of how many mitzvahs it is. So it was a machlokas rishonim, how to count it among the Tariq mitzvos. The Ramban understands that the chi of misa all the Chiyuvei Misa are all included under one directive that appears many times in the Chumash of Ubi'ar Tahara Mikirbecha, that all is packaged into one mitzvah. So one mitzvah, all the Misos Bezdin are all a part of that directive of Ubi'ar Tahara Mikirbecha. Well, the Rambam understands differently, and the Rambam has four mitzvahs. Why four? Because of Skila, Sreifa, Harig, and Chenek. So he counts each one as a separate mitzvah. And the Bahag disagrees, and the Bahag counts dozens of mitzvahs, because every time there's a Chi of mitzvah, and a Chi of Misa in the Torah, he counts that as a separate mitzvah. So what's the Yisod of that Machlokes? So perhaps the question is, what's the purpose of punishment? And you could see here three different models that the Ramban maybe understands, that the purpose of punishment is to protect society, that somebody who's running around killing people, so he's a danger to society, or maybe he's a spiritual danger to society with his influence, so you have to protect society. You have to remove the evildoer from your midst. So wherever Misa it is, and whatever specifics there are, it's all part of this broader category of one mitzvah, of the umbrella notion of Ubi'ar Tahara Mikirbecha. So that would be punishment for the good of society. There's another theory of punishment that's not necessarily for the good of society, but it's for the good of the offender. Let's say the rehabilitation model. So you punish somebody so that they will be better off themselves afterwards. So when it comes to the death penalty, it seems a little hard to apply that concept. They're not going to have an afterwards, except that from a religious perspective, so we believe there is a world to come. So there is a possibility of seeing even a Chiyuv Misa as something that is beneficial to the defendant. So that is another possibility here. Maybe that's the view of the Rambam, that when the Rambam says there's four mitzvos, so Skila, Sreif, Harig, and Chenek, so what's the value of breaking it down that way? So the four Chiyuvei Misa reflect four different levels of kapara. So perhaps that's the idea, that each one is saying give a level A kapara, level B kapara, level C kapara, level D kapara, and that essentially that's what distinguishes them. So the Torah is saying give a kapara to the avarian, and four different mitzvos for the four different levels of kapara. So therefore the focus is on essentially the punishment for the sake of the offender. And a third possibility is that punishment is for the sake of the law, that the law is not meaningful if it's not backed up, if there aren't any consequences. Maybe that's the view of the Bahag, that every time there is an Avera that has with it a Chiyuv Misa, so that Chiyuv Misa is a separate mitzvah to back up that Avera, that it should have consequences. And maybe that's why he counts each one separately. It's a third theory of punishment. So you have all these theories of punishment, and presumably, if this is a correct take on these Rishonim, presumably each one of these Rishonim doesn't disagree with the other one, that the other two, that those theories are there too, that the Onshin probably have all of these aspects mixed up in them. The question is just, what is the Iker? And each Rishon is holding on to a different main focus of the Onesh. So all of that is presumably true when we're talking about the Sanhedrin specifically. It has all of these aspects to it. The Chiyuv Misa that a Sanhedrin would carry out is for all of these purposes. But in the other systems, it's a little bit less clear. So one might say, okay, if you're telling me that it's so hard to get executed in the Sanhedrin, so that sounds nice. Okay, we have Rachmanis on people. And especially if there's a possibility at all, the individual is innocent, there's mitigating circumstances, so then yes, we're very relieved to hear that we're not going to be too likely to execute an innocent person. That's great. But On the other hand, as the Gemara mentions a response to that attitude, that im kein rabu shofei damim b'Yisrael, so you're going to have a lot of murderers running around because it's clear that there's no bite to the law. So people could just do whatever they want and there aren't going to be any consequences because all they have to do is make sure to wait 30 seconds after the hasra before committing their crime. It's pretty easy. So how do you protect society? So here the Ran has a drasha that made popular the concept of Mishpat HaMelech, which is really addressed already in the Gemara in a few places, where we have the notion Shamati, Shebezdin, Makin, Ve'onshin, Shalom Adin, that there is this notion, it's phrased that way, makes it sound a little secretive and shadowy, that they've heard that Bezdin is sometimes administers punishments Shalom Adin. So, and then the Gemara explains, Shalom HaNadeh means lo la'avar al divrei Torah. It doesn't mean against the Torah, but it means to support the Torah as a extra legal fashion. So if somebody is a danger to society, whether it's a physical danger to society or maybe an extreme spiritual danger to society, so Beis Din did have the authority, and it's a whole discussion under what circumstances and how exactly. But without getting into those details too much, but theoretically and practically, so the Melech, as the political and executive leader of the country, and the Sanhedrin, acting in that similar function, can protect society by taking the steps necessary against dangerous criminals. And regarding the death penalty, specifically in contemporary Israel. So the question came up in the early 1950s regarding the new state. So what should the policy be? Should they have the death penalty? And the Rabbanim who were consulted at that time, so they felt that, well, what exactly is our status? So we don't have all of the requirements to be a Sanhedrin, so to carry out Mises Beis Din as a Sanhedrin doesn't seem possible. So maybe there's a Malchus here of some type. So you could have a Mishpat HaMelech. We have a functional government. So you could have punishments carried out to protect society under the rubric of Mishpat HaMelech. But there, you don't have all those three functions that we said before. It's not for the purpose of a kapara or for a more theoretical purpose. It's really there simply to protect society. So if that's the case, these Rabbanim maintain, you can protect society with life imprisonment. You don't have to actually execute the offender. And therefore, we don't have any justification to actually execute anybody. So we're not going to have capital punishment was a decision. And out of Yom HaZeh, that's the policy, that you don't have capital punishment in Israel except for Nazi war criminals. And as you can also imagine, it's a policy that is constantly debated because, especially, and we feel all too strongly now, that with the presence of terrorism, so it's highly questionable whether life imprisonment really is an effective protection for society, especially when those who are imprisoned could end up becoming the target of hostage taking, that they're looking to set them free. So again, we know too well right now. So that raises serious questions about whether it's a correct assessment that not executing them is a correct policy. But in any event, that's a part of the question here. So what exactly would be the operating principle for a Beis Din to execute? And that was their premise there, that it's only what's necessary to protect society in the category of Mishpat HaMelech, and the decision flows from there. So that would be regarding the second category. But there's also a third category, and that may be the most relevant. And that category is the concept of Din, the issue that is derived from last week's parasha and this week's parasha, the notion of the Sheva Mitzvah B'nei Noach, and one of those mitzvahs being the mitzvah of justice. So it was a machlokes, the Rambam and the Ramban, what exactly that mitzvah entails. The Rambam actually, it's unusual, you look to Mishnah Torah to find the interpretation of the story in Chumash, but that's the case here, that in Parshas Vayishlach, so the Torah tells the story of how Shimon and Levi executed the whole city of Shechem, and the question is, why did they do that? So the Rambam explains in Mishnah Torah, in Parak Das, of Hilchos Melachim, that they were carrying out the mitzvah of din, because he understands that the mitzvah of din is to enforce the other six mitzvahs. Din is the one positive mitzvah among the Sheva mitzvahs. The other six are Averos. So the one positive mitzvah is to enforce the other six. And that's what it means to set up a court system to do that. And that essentially Shimon and Levi, they were addressing the fact that the city of Shechem, they failed to judge the individual of Shechem for his violation of the Noahide Code, and therefore they were in violation of the Noahide Code for the Bittul Mitzvah Din, so they were all Chayiv Misa for that. And the Ramban disagrees, and the Ramban says that there's a bunch of questions on this, but among his questions is that the assumption the Rambam seems to have is that Shimon and Levi were right in what they did. And if they were right, so then, well, Yaakov should have done it himself. And if you're going to say Yaakov was older and scared, so then he shouldn't have been angry at them. So it doesn't sound from the way Yaakov reacts that they did the right thing at all. And Yaakov comes back and rebukes them again in Parshas Vayechi. So the premise that they were right, it doesn't seem to be correct, says the Ramban. And he also understands the whole concept differently. He says that the mitzvah of din, his understanding is a very big chiddush. He says that all of Choshen Mishpat is applicable to non-Jews also. That basically means that all of our monetary laws are applicable both to Jews and to non-Jews, and that's what the mitzvah of din means. The Rama has a tshuva about this also. It's a fascinating question. So one way or another, we have a mitzvah of din, which does involve setting up a court system, and the Gemara, and Daf Nun Ches, appropriately in Sanhedrin, talks about this concept, and the Gemara says that there's an obligation for the civil courts, the non-Jewish courts, to adjudicate their populations and to carry out punishments. So if that's the case, it would seem that this is the source, this is the context that's most relevant to the question of the death penalty. And then really the pendulum swings all the way in the other direction, because then the question isn't, do we have a justification to give the death penalty? It seems the question is, do we ever have a justification not to give the death penalty? Because the Gemara says that the standard, the default for Misas, for the mitzvos of Bnei Noach, a violation of the mitzvos of Bnei Noach, is that it's always Zechiv Misas, Harasa, and Zohi Misasin. So if that's the case, so then we should maybe think we have a death penalty for everything, not only that it should exist, but that it should be applied to every violation of the Noahide Code. So that seems very difficult to say. In the other direction, that seems like overkill, no pun intended. So how exactly do we address that, that you don't find that being advocated by anybody? So there is a interesting sushtal we could note, that to give a little personal history, sort of, here in this. So many years ago, you'd be able to figure out just how many years ago it was, listen to the story. So I was in a store, and they had on the racks there a magazine of an issue of New York Magazine, and the cover story was the 100 Smartest New Yorkers. And I was proud to see that among the 100 Smartest New Yorkers, so two of them were affiliated with Yeshiva University. And one of these two was Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. So that's beautiful. It's very nice. There was only two problems. One is that Rav Aaron wasn't a New Yorker. He commuted from Chicago. And also the picture that they had in the magazine it was a picture of his brother, Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. So two problems, but other than that, it was still nice to see Rav Aaron here acknowledged as one of the 100 smartest, somewhat New Yorkers. And the magazine then also had to prove, show you how each one of these people deserved a place on the list. So it's not a book, it's only a magazine, so it couldn't go into too much detail. So for every person on the list, it had a picture, a name, a picture of their brother, and a quote to show you how smart they are. So what was Rav Aaron's quote? So here you can figure out when this was. So George Pataki had just been elected governor of New York, and he ran on a pro-death penalty platform that the previous governor, Mario Cuomo, had gotten rid of the death penalty in New York, and Pataki said we should bring it back, and he won the election. So Rav Aaron was a big political liberal, so he made a comment there. He said that you have to be very careful about this, that the Talmud says that a Beis Din, a Sanhedrin, that would execute once every 70 years is a bloody Sanhedrin. Governor Pataki, you should be very careful to make sure that New York doesn't become a bloody state. So based on everything that we've said so far, that seems to be a surprising association, because we were saying that the sources here are in three different contexts, and it would seem that anything addressed to George Pataki is about the civil standards in New York State. So that's about the concept of din. That's about the Bnei Noach courts. So to use a quote that's relevant to how the Sanhedrin operated, as we explained at some length, so that wouldn't seem to be relevant necessarily to a Ben Noach court, which would be the proper context for Governor Pataki. So how could you explain this? So it would seem that Rav Aaron's quote is l'shitoso with another position he took in a better magazine, in a better periodical, the Beis Yitzchak Journal. So in Yeshiva University's Talmudical Journal, the Beis Yitzchak, so Rav Aaron wrote an article once upon a time about the mitzvah of din. And he took on this question over there of the assumption that there should be a chiyuv mitzvah for every violation of the din of Bnei Noach. And he suggests there that the idea of chiyuv mitzvah for Bnei Noach reflects the fact that, like we said again at the earlier part, that if there are many different purposes for punishment, so that's true for the Sanhedrin, but the Ben Noach court, they're there to keep society from falling apart. Like the Mishnah says, having mispalel b'shlem mishal malchus, that we have to pray for the government, because otherwise people will eat each other alive. So we need to have the court there in place to keep society standing. So he understood that it's in that spirit that we have a standard of the Chiyuv Mitzvah for Bnei Noach. It doesn't mean, he said, that you have to always apply Chiyuv Mitzvah for every violation, for all the Gazlanim, every violation of the Ben Noach code has to be Chiyuv Mitzvah. So rather, what it means is that the Dayan has discretion, that he can go up to and including Misa for a crime if he feels it's necessary to keep society functional. And should he decide that there needs to be a Chiyuv Misa, so then that would not be a violation of Risicha. He has that right, but he has the discretion to do less than that. It's just the upper limit. So explained Rav Aaron that that's the way one should look at it, that not that the Ben Noach judge has a obligation to give Misa for everything, but that he has that discretion to go up to Misa if necessary. But if the goals of protecting society, keeping society functional, could be accomplished with less, then he also has the right to give less, whatever tools he has, in order to accomplish that goal. So if that's the understanding, so then perhaps you could understand what he means in New York Magazine. So the fact that he was looking to address Pataki with a quote that seems to be from a different context from how the Sanhedrin, so you could understand that in light of his position in Beis Yitzchak, that the Dayanim have the discretion, but they could do less than Misa. So it's all about how they use their insight and their assessment of the situation to decide what to do. So given that that's what's going on, so that it makes sense that Rivera may feel, okay, so Governor Pataki, your system is going to have to assess what's right here with wisdom and care. So you should take a lesson from the rabbis of the Sanhedrin, that they were very, very careful in using their version of capital punishment, and they only carried it out very rarely. So you too should be the same way, that you should look to their model and get some perspective from that. So within that kind of an understanding, it makes a lot of sense. He's not denying the fact that they're from different contexts, but he's saying that the discretion of the Benoach authority can be informed by looking to what the Sanhedrin did in terms of their policies. And it happens to be that Moshe Feinstein, who is portrayed as having a very different view than Rav Aaron about death penalty, which is possible, but in terms of the general understanding, if you look, he has a tshuva about this in the Gris Moshe, which was written to another New York State governor. So it's a interesting, very narrow club here, New York State governors who were addressed by a great poskim about the death penalty. But Hugh Carey was the recipient of a letter from Moshe Feinstein, a generation before George Pataki. But Hugh Carey received a letter from Moshe about the death penalty, and the Lumdus is not spelled out the same way. But essentially, Moshe is taking a similar position in terms of the concept, because he's not saying that you should execute all the gazlanim. He's not saying that every violation of the mitzvos b'nei Noach deserves mitzvah, but explaining the role that it theoretically could have when you have a society that is given to Ritzicha, or that is very much a threat of violent behavior, so then it could be appropriate. And he's also very careful there to note that you have to make sure that the motives are correct. It could be that the politicians are looking to use it to look tough on crime or something like that, so then that would be a very dangerous ulterior motive. So he goes through the different aspects of the issue, but in theory, it could be that it's called for, it could also be otherwise, and it needs to be, again, something that's handled with wisdom and discretion, which he shares some of that in his tshuva to that New York governor. So there is a lot to consider about this very difficult issue, and the common perception that there is a theoretical and an actual, that the Torah has this concept in order for it to be there on the books, but didn't mean necessarily for it to be carried out too often. It might be correct. It could be that that's the case, but what we tried to illustrate here is that there's a longer process here in order to get to that, and it very much also depends on what the need of the moment is and what exactly is the assessment. Just like we see going on right now, there's a lot that has to be very carefully considered and addressed in terms of what the world needs to balance the punishment of those who commit terrible crimes and to protect those who could be harmed by them in the future, and to act with justice and wisdom. And Kadosh Baruch Hu should give the proper das and the proper chachma, so that everything should be carried out in the way that is the man ha'emes and the man ha'shalom. So I wish you all a good night, and God willing, next week we'll talk about something else. Right. Yashar Koach.